jazz.
Bastard.
I'm ready. Let's do this thing.
All right. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 160. A horse is a horse, of course, and I'm Horse Pat.
What's wrong, Wilbur? Do you have a cold?
One thing my mother taught me, and I should listen to more, was always listen to the Wu-Tang Clan. And one of the things they taught me, if I'd listened, was... The best of tech, your neck. The best of tech, your neck.
The best of tech, your neck. The best of tech, your neck.
So I was playing ball Monday, and a really nice guy. I mean, he wasn't trying to hurt me at all, but he was going up for the ball. I was going up for the ball, and he's shorter than I am, and I got an elbow to the throat.
Nice.
And it's lingered, man. It's like having a cold or something. I guess the irritation is the same or something. So I'm still kind of a little hoarse, a little.
Well, I thought you were going to tell me some sob story about, you know, polar vortexes and bullshit like that. Because let me tell you, it's cold here. It's 60 right now, and every night it gets down to about 52. So,
that's,
you know,
rough.
It is brutal out here, let me tell you.
Yeah, Wednesday we scraped about -6. That's as hot as it got. But, you know, it's going to be like 60 Saturday or Sunday. So it's just insane.
Right.
Today's kind of around freezing. We got a couple inches of snow yesterday. It's going to be gone by Sunday. It's just a weird, weird roller coaster. We have everything pretty much shut down. Yeah.
I saw when I was working out, someone had MSNBC up and they had posted our president's tweet about, you know, how about that global warming or whatever. And the weather guy on MSNBC, you know, he just said, all right, let's just go through this one more time. Weather is not the same as climate.
Yeah, I know. God.
He like sort of like, he's like, here's a primer for idiots. Weather, climate, not the same. You know,
wow.
It's really funny.
Oh, gosh. And it wasn't like that famous tweet also misspelled one major word. Anyway,
yeah,
global
whammy.
Yeah. Well, there is no such. I agree. There is no such thing as global whamming. Yeah,
hey,
I'm on board with that. But what else?
Never had my globe whammed yet, but
yeah.
I'm gonna try anything once.
I want to wait till I feel better for that. Anyway, whamming right along. We're gonna do another all new releases show. These are 2018 and maybe in a case or so, I'm not sure, 2019 releases. We've been gathering a lot in our inboxes, though I think, going to see if we can maybe do some historical stuff in the near future.
Yeah.
And, you know, just kind of break things up. I've been enjoying the new stuff. It's just, you know, we like to have a mix here. And we had several people write in pretty recently, which is always appreciated. And, you know, one of them pointed out, well, you know, if you haven't heard it before, it's new to you. And yeah, I think it's true of all of us. I was telling him, and among other things, you know, I'm getting into classical music more and more, needless to say. Much of that was written a long time ago, but it's new to me, so it's the same deal. And
yeah.
We like to do stuff from history as well as brand new. But this episode, it's all brand new stuff. So I think we both picked a couple, right? What were your picks?
If memory serves, mine were Christina Coller's Perception and Dave Harrington's, I think I gave you the wrong title before, it's Pure Imagination, No Country. I think I told you it was called Pure Imagination, and in fact, it's Pure Imagination, No Country.
Right. I eventually got my notes updated, and sure, it's an interesting title. I mean, it kind of, I don't quite, I guess, but maybe No Country and Western? I'm not quite sure what the addendum is about, but it's a very imaginative album. And so I picked a couple as well. The NPO Trio, and we'll talk about the members of that when we discuss it, Live at the Stone, and the Eden Barraquette, and I'm just probably butchered the poor fellow's name.
No, I think that sounds pretty good to me. I think that's probably right.
Knight, and Eden is a baritone saxophone player, and his brother is one of the other members of his trio. So, well, I assume we're going to do the singer last, because we tend to kind of go on and on about singers, but do you have a preference otherwise where we begin?
Nah, it's fine. Wherever you want to go first.
Okay, well, maybe let's start with this trio by Eden Barraquette. a knight. He's a baritone saxophone player. He also plays clarinet on this album. His brother Orr Barraquette plays bass, and Felix Lacaros drums. He's Argentina-born Israeli baritone saxophone player, and I've just found out but not had a chance to listen to the fact that somewhere on the internet, his trio does a cover of Don't Give Up by Peter Gabriel. Also, I found out today that he appears on jazzberrysax.com. And so now I know that a website called jazzberrysax.com exists. That's kind of cool. Who knew?
Well, it's cool that his name is, it's cool that, you know, he plays Barry and his last name is Barraquette.
Absolutely. That's right.
I wonder, was his brother younger and he just wasn't allowed to play the Barry because Eden got to the Barry first? I don't know.
Well, but he's playing bass. So, I mean, yeah, it's a family of low tones. So, yeah, the cover's very striking. He's there with his baritone saxophone holding the moon in his hand. It's obviously a pretty minimalist setup. One horn less than Jerry Mulligan's famous pianoless quartet. And I'd say there's a lot of, I don't want to say minimalist, but riff-based tunes based on simple motifs that get repeated. Did you like this one? What do you think of Night?
As I listened to it, I kind of thought, I bet Pat just loves the shit out of this. I did like it. I thought it was pretty good. I always like hearing baritone sax, and I especially kind of like it when I really can hear it. In other words, where it's not just given a lick or two, but you can actually, it's allowed to, when the Barry gets some, right? And this entire album is, it's a trio date, but it's really about Eden's saxophone or his bass clarinet. And yeah, you're right, it's very riff-based. And in general, I found it pretty pleasing. I thought it was a good deal of fun for the most part. Well, fun's not quite the right word. Barry sax playing can be kind of funny or comical. And this doesn't have the kind of po-faced seriousness that Mulligan can sometimes get up to, although he's occasionally puckish. And it doesn't have some of the sense of humor that one associates with a player like, say, Harry Carney. Right. It's but it's not morose or moody. It seems to be kind of fairly upbeat, up-tempo kind of, as you said, riff-based set of songs that really, you know, showcase what Eden can do on those two horns. There's a couple of songs where the rhythm gets a little bit of work, right? Children's Play is a little bit of a feature. Feature's too strong a word. The drummer gets some.
Yeah.
But it's not, none of these songs you would really say focus on the other two players at all. If I have a complaint, and it's not a huge complaint, it's just that for me, there were no super memorable earworms on this. Like whenever it came on, I was like, yeah, right on, cool, that was good. But I didn't catch, none of the melodies stuck with me at all. And on at least a couple of the other albums we're going to talk about, there are definite earworms floating around out there that really burrowed deep into my consciousness. So that sounds like a criticism, and maybe it's not really. It's just that this is a very kind of low-key, enjoyable album by a pretty talented player. He's done work in larger contexts. He's been in someone, you probably are looking at a website or something that could tell us, but he's done work with some other heavier hitters, and I'd be interested to hear him in those settings. But what's pleasurable about this is that, you know, the Barry holds its own here as a kind of voice that you're willing to listen to and follow along. So yeah, I, you know, found this enjoyable, not epic or earth-shattering. And I guess I might have liked to have had one melody that I could kind of, you know, wrap my head around and just keep in my head. And none of these quite did that for me. Anyway, in general, a positive experience. I thought it was pretty good. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I like the ensemble idea. I think I agree with you. And you kind of put your finger on it. And the minute you said it, it kind of clicked. Oh, yeah, you're right. You know, the bass and the drums are a little more functional. You know, this is not about a lot of wild interplay. You know, this is not Scott LaFaro with Jerry Mulligan or something.
Right. And it's Sonny Rollins with anyone else.
There you go. I do mention Mulligan in part because this guy's tonal conception, and apparently he's a master of the altissimo range of the horn.
Yeah.
And gives, there's like, you can find lessons and things online from him. Runs to the lighter side of the gamut. I mean, he's tonally a lot closer to Mulligan than Harry Carney. This is not a ripe sound. It's not a sound that's focused on the bottom half of the horn's range.
No, no. But, and in part, that's because he's, you know, doing melody rather than filling bass line. You know, he's not part of an ensemble.
But I think this also his conception, at least at this point in his career, you know, because you can, you know, we've heard Harry Carney on that ballad album with strings he did. You know, you can kind of burp out a beautiful, and I should never say that. He never burps. I mean, he's always got this amazing, rich, but just really ripe, you know, resonant tone. And you can play songs like that, but Eden doesn't really do that. And in a way, it's like the kind of rhythm section you might have with Mulligan, though, of course, the rhythms are different, right? This is not playing old style swing, and that's a good thing, but you don't have that extra horn. So I don't know whether throwing in another horn in there or letting maybe the drummer and the bass have a little bit more to do would vary the textures a bit more. But, you know, that's something I think about in the next release. I agree that melodically, there's not a lot to hang your hat on here. He does one cover of a song by an Israeli composer, Lost Melody by Mati Kaspi. And again, I'm sure I butchered that name. My apologies. It's a melody I do not know. But in a way, I was thinking, well, if he really does Don't Give Up by Peter Gabriel, I almost wish he put that on the record, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I was reading an interview with a young vocalist, and she was talking about, well, anytime you do something contemporary, people say you're selling out. And I thought, it just drove me up the wall. I keep thinking I'm going to write this song about the jazz repertoire, but it's like, I just every great jazz musician sold out then, apparently. I mean, because all of them covered, you know, it's like Thelonious Monk, huge sellout, Duke Ellington, big sellout, you know, just Miles Davis, huge sellout. I mean, they all were doing songs that were at least within 10 years spitting distance of the moment they were recording them, often more recent. And this idea that doing contemporary music is somehow not authentic, it makes me a grumpy old bastard. And, you know, I'd love to hear this guy do an album that was maybe half originals and half. I'm not saying it's got to be, you know, Softly as in a Morning Sunrise. To be honest, I prefer Peter Gabriel, or I prefer, you know, whatever touch this young man or Israeli, you know, whatever it would be. Right now, I think even in his improvs, which are impressively fluid, I don't necessarily have riffs or ideas, melodic kernels that are catching my ear yet. So, yeah, I think he's good. And in fact, I was thinking for a while, and at first I thought, great, he's doing some riffing. This isn't like super abstract. This isn't jazz school stuff. Great. And then I went through a phase of saying, well, man, it seems like it's almost mainly all riffing. You know, there's a little bit too much of the repetition. And then I realized, no, for certain songs, he is soloing here at length. But if I'm not careful and I don't have it cranked and I'm not focused on it, I don't get grabbed. There's some soloists that, you know, unless they're just inaudible, your ears perk up, you start forgetting what you're reading about, and your attention kind of swivels over their direction. And he's not there yet for me. But I like the concept. I like this idea of a baritone-led session. I think it's great. Hell, I wouldn't mind a few more trombone-led sessions. We have some of them, but, you know, we could have more. I might draw the line at bassoon, but who knows? Convince me. But it's a cool idea. And this is somebody I'd like to hear another couple releases down the road, what he's up to, because he's quite young. And, you know, this is promising. Anyway, that's Eden Barakat's Night, and he's somebody to watch out for. Why don't we move over to Dave Harrington then?
Sure.
This surprisingly Brooklyn-based guitar player.
Why do you say surprisingly? Oh, you're being ironic.
I'm being an ironic son of a bitch. born 1986. I guess his main group here is keyboardist Andrew Fox, drummer Samer Godfrey. And again, sorry, Samer or Samer. I don't know. I suck. And then there are various visiting musicians. So this is one you picked out. What do you think of Harrington's electric guitar opus here?
Well, I'll tell you, so this is a good example of just, the randomness of my mind. I've just always loved the Lieber, I think it's Jerry Lieber Stahl, the Lieber and Stahl, or is it Anthony Newley? I love Pure Imagination. I just fucking love that song. Love it to death. Can't hear it enough. Love covers of it. I don't think I've ever heard a cover of it that I didn't like. Some covers I like better than others. So I remember when we were thinking about stuff, I was like, oh yeah, there was that guitar player who did that really, for me, evocative, mellow cover of Pure Imagination. Although, that's not quite right. I want to say more about that in a second. So that's literally why I selected it, because of that, goddamn cover. But this is pretty good also. It's very stringy and electric and treated, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
So you've got your, he plays guitar and bass. There is a drummer here, but everyone else is doing something electronic, something somewhere, right? You've got a keyboard player, you got a violinist, you got an electric pianist, you get a vibraphone player, and we have someone playing something called Moog Rogue, whatever that is.
Hold on.
It's not a rogue
grab it.
It's a Moog Rogue, which, that's probably something that I should know, but I just don't, right? Like, there are probably like Moog specialists out there going, you fucking asshole. But when I read that, I just thought it was really funny. Moog Rogue. Is it a Moog that is on wheels? You have to chase it around the studio? What is that? Anyway, so yeah, it's very heavily treated music, lots and lots of studio jockeying going on here. Personally, I tend to prefer the more mellow numbers. I don't know if you had that response, but it's not that I don't like it when he shreds or when the group gets shreddy, but I found the mellower stuff a little more ear-catching. I'm not quite sure why that is. So Dreams Field, a little short piece, seems, kind of like ambient, feels very like ambient music, electronic ambient music. I liked that cut a lot. I tend to like Belgrade Fever, although that builds in the middle. It has a little more organic tension that gets created over the course of the number, but it also has a kind of mellow, spacey feel. It starts this kind of spacey place. I like that a lot. I love Pure Imagination. It's as if Bill Frisell was playing it, but with like a lot of electronic backup, like he had a lot of friends show up in the studio to like back him up while he did his thing. This guy reminds me sometimes of Frisell in that he has this sort of clear, open, thoughtful tone, but that he can like fuzz out and get a little skronky. He's not as square-jawed a player in some ways as Frisell is. He's a little more angular at times. But yeah, I liked the mellower stuff here a little bit better than the busy stuff. Not that the busy stuff was bad, but like something that starts out kind of busy and stays kind of busy isn't as interesting to me with this player. Now, I'm going to guess that you thought some of this was just wanking around and was kind of noodly and not very interesting, but I tended to get drawn into this guy's soundscape. I'm going to guess that like a number like Patch One, the longest cut on the album, it's like 11 and a half minutes. I'm going to guess you think that probably should have been about 5 minutes shorter.
But with that kind of a tune, in a sense, is its purpose just kind of a drifting soundscape? So does it matter? You know, it's not like the form is...
Right. You're like, it could be 2 minutes, it could be two hours.
You know, and it... That's not necessarily, and there's a place for that in my life. It's obviously not the only kind of music I'd ever want to listen to, but
no. Sure,
you know, if you want to drift. You know, the guy that whose name popped into my head as a kind of comparison contrast thing was Steve Tibbetts.
Oh, sure.
And his very best stuff, you know, the handful of my favorite albums by him. Yeah, I like a lot more. Of course, I've also lived with him for many, many years, and so that's not really fair. I don't know if I live with this album for another 10, 15, 20 years where it would be. I think that, as you said, the electronics... The haze, I don't have any objection to it philosophically at all. But what I think Tibbetts had in his best stuff was more textures to play with. You know, he'd go full acoustic. He would go overdriven screaming guitar that really was a little bit more in your face and distorted than anything that Harrington does. And so that really wide range. And of course, the percussion on those albums is just so driving and beautifully articulated, and of course they've got ECM in their back pocket as the studio,
right.
So you know it's a little hard to duplicate something that good unless you're there or you've got somebody who's really gifted at sound. And this is a fine sounding album, but it isn't quite, especially with records that, you know, are not based around melodies and aren't necessarily, I mean, there's soloing here, there's a lot of creativity, there's a lot of playing, but this is not like an album about solos per se.
No.
You know, I'm going to express myself in a, you know, in a statement of improvised melody. It's more about textures and events and, you know, interacting, but it's not necessarily him just showing off what he can do with some given form.
It reminded that when you said soundscape, I think that's a good term. And to me, it's like, If you watch indie films, one of the standard rules in indie films is that you have to have some sort of noodling acoustic guitar in the soundtrack, some sort of lugubrious noodling acoustic guitar. And I would much rather have Dave Harrington do the soundtrack to any indie movie for the next 20 years. This sounds like the soundtrack to a movie that I want to see that movie. That's kind of how I felt when I listened to it. You know, it's like, oh, that's interesting. It's kind of spacey, but it's got some energy. We're being joined by my neighbor.
I was going to say, he is a strong acoustic guitar.
He is not happy with David.
He's like, no, don't ruin my favorite indie movies. Don't you dare.
Everything you said is wrong. Anyway, yeah, I just kept thinking as I listened to this, like, I would like to see the movie that this is the soundtrack to.
Yeah, I'm often treated when I step in my backyard to dogs like two houses away getting really upset about him. Like, you know, look at a plat map, you fuckers. I own this part of the land. This is not your yard. Shut up.
Right.
But they can't figure that out. It's like maybe it would become their yard, or I might jump over two fences and get to them. It's just terrible. Yeah, right. You can imagine this as kind of, I don't want to, you know, implies ambient or that there's no melodic interest here and that it's background. It's not, but it, you know, it's more in that area than I'd say even in a Tibbetts production, which is very atmospheric, but is also at times it's demands that you kind of snap to attention and, you know, is kind of, it's putting you on its own trip.
Let me ask you a question. Would you imagine that this would be a really good group to hear live?
God, I don't know. I don't know, because so much of it is, I honestly can't guess, because it's, some of it is atmospheric, some of it's about these textures. I don't know if it's that much more exciting to see somebody do that in front of you.
I get a feeling live there's going to be a little more moments of built-in tension and more, a little more tension between the players on stage. The other thing that we've talked about that this reminded me of a little bit would be the necks. Reminds me of the necks a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. It's not as methodical
or
committed to a procedure, right? You know, I mean, they're really like, okay, we're doing this thing. And this is a little bit more eclectic, a little bit more, you know, just kind of experimenting with different modes, but in a fairly narrow band, but not as narrow as the necks. Which, you know, also, you might argue, makes it maybe a little bit less cumulatively powerful than the best of the next. I think in general, I think it would be interesting. And again, nothing against electronics, nothing against synthesizers. You know, I am not a purist, but maybe to throw in and some kind of acoustic player to bounce off things. And I guess in a way too, you're pointing out that
banjo.
Both, they're absolutely, yeah.
I'm sorry. You
know, I'm not mad at David Harrington. I've got nothing against David Harrington. It's like,
well,
come on.
Banjos are acoustic.
They are. They are. Yeah, that's true. Not everything acoustic is good. Sousaphone, also loud. But I guess in both this group and in Eden's, I think the group works, but it's not necessarily a sense of it being greater than the sum of its parts or a conversation that's really kind of pressing all the participants to kind of greater heights. And again, not being hypercritical, I'm not saying these are ineffective or unmusical or plotting. You know, I mean, you know, we've got examples in our minds of bad groups, you know, Coleman Hawkins, Body and Soul, the backing band kind of sucks on that one. But just you aren't listening to this thinking, my God, what a great group. And I think that's true of both Night and Pure Imagination, No Country. They're good. But I mean, the interaction is not necessarily the calling card. And, you know, I liked it. I think it's pleasant for the most part. There's some more challenging things. I mean, if you want pure, clear tonality at all times, I'd avoid it. But this is not like a skronk fest. This isn't like super experimental or, you know, he's scraping the guitar with a knife blade. And it's not that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm not yet. This is not the album that made me a believer, I guess, you know, as somebody who's going to like become a Harrington fanatic. But yeah, it was fine. It was good. You know, if you like that kind of drifting, soundtracky, but not ambient sound, you'll probably like this. And if you like banjo, you're out of luck. Maybe next time. So this next one, I was actually worried if I was going to drive you up the wall with it, because it has two things that Mike prefers in small doses and very large doses, and that is a soprano saxophone player who leans towards the dry, and violin.
Yes.
And there are heaping helpings of both here, and yet this album, I don't know, I feel like it's pretty damn successful. This is the NPO Trio, Live at the Stone. This is a group comprised of three musicians, needless to say, and their names come, that's where the NPO comes from, Jean-Michel Pilk.
Okay, we should just make a new rule. I do the names.
Okay.
Because I'm going to get closer. It's not because, you know why it is? It's I have all these foreign students, so I spend a lot of time learning how to pronounce foreign names.
It's okay, help us out here, Mike. Just give us the names.
I do enjoy you.
You do more than our listeners.
I shouldn't be abusive. Jean-Michel Pilk.
Okay. Pilk.
Pilk. Pilk. Like milk. Pilk.
Okay.
And then Meg Okura and Sam Newsom. I should have let you have Sam Newsom. You probably could handle that.
I don't know. I thought it was Newsomi. So
Newsomi.
There you go. And so Sam and I looked on the internet. You can too, kids. Meg is married to Sam.
I did not know that.
And both of them are also in the Pan Asian Chamber Jazz Ensemble, which we've recently got a review copy for, and which is very enjoyable. And I think in some ways, if you're looking for something a little bit less challenging and abrasive, you might turn there.
Yeah.
It's a bigger group. And it's not quite as intense. You know, I was thinking of Two Flowers on a Stem, the John Jang album we did.
Yeah.
And the Pan-Asian Chamber Jazz Ensemble is not as in-your-face or potentially abrasive as that group could be. She's apparently of Japanese Jewish descent, and she is fascinated by the intersection of these cultures. So This album is broken into 8 tracks, but the first 6 are really part of one long improvisation. And then there's a short breather. And then the final one is a combination of a Jewish and Japanese folk songs that she felt had a family resemblance as the improvisatory material. But it's piano, violin, and soprano sax. And it is, my understanding, they began with, you know, some motifs or some ideas, but this is largely improvised. Uh-oh, the cat just realized there's a headphone cord she can bite. This is very exciting for her. So if I suddenly cut out, we'll know why. So did you survive this, I think, really excellent album of improvised music, but one that does feature both violin and, let's say, a dry martini of a soprano saxophone?
Yeah, it's a good thing that I had gotten the review copy of the Pan Asian thing, because I listened to that also, called Ima Ima. That features a lot of sort of overt nods to Asian influences. It's got songs on there about jade and the birth of Shakyamuni, you know, the Buddha and all of that. And that's a mellower version of this. This is... So you got to put on your big boy pants for this. You probably need to put on the big boy headphones, but it's not going to necessarily create pleasure. There are moments of pleasure here. There are moments that I really like, but there's almost never an entire cut that I really enjoy. Listening to this sometimes feels like a chore. In virtually every song, I can single out moments, in virtually every improv, I can single out moments where I think, oh yeah, that's beautiful, right? That's lovely. I love the start of the first improvisation. It's just breathtakingly beautiful, right? The start of the second improvisation, I don't like so much, but then it gets kind of interesting in the middle for me. So when this is at its most... most prohibitively abstract, these two sounds, atonal violin and soprano sax, really, they push my Steve Lacy buttons in a bad way, and I get cranky. I can't put up with a lot of that for a very long time. It gets really frustrating. But then there are other moments here of just, you know, ravishing beauty in virtually every song. In fact, I don't think there's a moment in I think every song has a moment where I kind of go, oh yeah, I like that passage, or I like that moment. But it feels kind of abstractly third streamy, like we're gonna do some really heavy avant-garde classical oblique weightlifting now, and you're gonna come along. And as much as I admire that, it doesn't necessarily give me pleasure. So that's what I meant. Like, sometimes it feels like a chore to listen to this. There are just places where it gets so oblique or so angular that it's a little nails on the blackboard for me. And you know, I have a pretty high tolerance for some of this stuff, but this particular combination really gives me fits sometimes. But like I said, fortunately, every song does have a moment, a passage, sometimes at the beginning, sometimes at the end, where it suddenly becomes very lyrical and pretty, and I can kind of get with the program. But as a whole, this was the disc that gave me the most trouble this week. It's just there are moments that I'm like, okay, now I'm doing homework, you know. And then there are other moments where I was like, oh yeah, that's beautiful. And, you know, no diss to any of the players. They're all extraordinarily good. And clearly they're really empathic, the way they respond to one another. At an academic level, I can really appreciate the craftsmanship and the skill involved. It just doesn't always please me. I don't find the experience throughout pleasant. I find it occasionally pleasant, usually interesting, sometimes difficult. If you don't have a head for abstract, this is not going to make you happy. If you're someone who comes to this from, the jazz of Jean-Michel Pilk, you're going to be this is a hard, this is a heavy leap. This is a high leap for folks coming to this from that angle. If you're already familiar with Megakura and Sam Newsome, then you know this won't seem that strange. But yeah, this sort of feels like I'm a, but which is much more user friendly, has many more moments of lyrical beauty, and this has fewer, right? Or they're just spaced out between moments of difficult abstract playing that doesn't necessarily produce, for this listener anyway, pleasure. You like it a lot, though.
I do. Yeah, I would. I'd say this is a very strong record, but it involves. I was reading up. I knew some had been kind of somebody I would been aware of for years. I probably read an article about him. So, Newsom, who was born in 65, worked for a little while with Terence Blanchard, among other people, decided in 1995 that he was going to focus exclusively on soprano. And
what was he doing before that? Also,
well, I
what,
think
tenor?
Just other reeds, tenor. Okay. And I think he'd always played some, but, it's one of those instruments that either it's your second or you can, like a Steve Lacy, devote yourself to it because it's such a tough instrument to master. The intonation is tough and just producing sound on it's a challenge. And it can be a lifetime of study or, some people just tire of it. They don't want to be doing nothing but it. But anyway, and then Meg is a little bit younger than he is, born in 73, and Pilk, 1960. So, we're looking at a range here of 13 years. They're all roughly the same generation. Newsom can do things with the soprano, a lot of extended techniques. I mean, it sounds like a squirrel is doing a raspberry into a fan. They can roar. And as a sound, it's just not pretty. But structurally, I feel like he's a player that just always seems to have a very clear sense of exactly why he's playing what he's playing. To a degree that might almost be oppressive, but it, as a structuralist, he just seems to know exactly where he's going. And the group, to me, is able to kind of find moments of togetherness and just a kind of the play. It's not patterned. It doesn't sound prearranged, but it does sound like they keep finding forms, finding a mutual direction to go in, developing climaxes together. I don't know. It just seems like it's just a very organic trio that really benefits from listening to one another and really was finding something that particular evening. It's like, this is going well, but some of it isn't pretty. And I'd say mainly, it's not, I don't think that Akura's violin playing is super abrasive very often, but Newsom is willing, if he feels like that the moment in the improvisation calls for the brrr sound that the squirrel makes in the fan, he'll do it for a minute.
Am I right in thinking he's able to achieve multiphonics with regularity on this horn? Because it sounds like that's what he's doing.
Yeah, I think he also can circular breathe. He may also have a pipeline to Satan who gives him superpower. He's really...
There are places where it seems like he's deliberately splitting the...
Oh,
splitting
sure, absolutely.
Tone. And I will agree with you on this. I don't necessarily find that pleasant, but I never think it's accidental. It's like it's a choice that he's making. He knows exactly why he's doing it.
We feel like, Albert Eiler or somebody, he's playing that way because he just can't contain the vision. It's kind of spilling out of him. Whereas the Newsom is like, he's playing that way because at that moment, he believes that's what's required for the idea he's trying to express. But it is absolutely, the left brain has got a ironclad grip on it. It's just that to me, there is a kind of the group itself, almost like a larger consciousness that is expressing something that is deeply musical. This is not, there's a lot of control, but I guess ultimately it seems like it's leading to something that is beautiful in a very austere way. This is not the beauty of lushness. Let's face it, this is not overripe romanticism, but there is a weird kind of beauty there of people who are really attuned to what they're trying to achieve together and achieving it. So yeah, I was really struck by this record, and I put it on at the risk of driving you up the wall, because I think it is, it's also, you know, it's, this is, there's a tonality, but I don't think of this as, it's not at the expressionist end of free blowing, right? It's not energy music at that sense at all. It's that kind of in between. And again, the tonality of players, and I'm not necessarily somebody who's looking for a violin paired with an alto sax or a soprano saxophone either. You know, that's can be kind of demanding on the ear. But I feel like it does just, and this is the only album really, every other, the records are fairly short this week. Three of them are all in the 40-minute range. This one goes an hour. So it's also just a more sustained thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it is, in a way, I mean, it's a trio. I guess Barraquette's a trio too, but at a very different level of intensity. The trio-ness of this is so much more pronounced, and the dependency of one another on creating expression is so much more pronounced here. So it is, it's more demanding in that sense. And they don't have, you know, there is no drummer, there are certainly rhythmic moments and grooves, but it's not as riff-based a music at all. So yeah, I would really strongly recommend it, but obviously with the caveat that, yeah, it is austere. I think that's the adjective for the day for me for this album. I think it's beautiful, but the way maybe a Greek temple is, not the way, I don't know, a really comfy bachelor pad with rugs everywhere and throw pillows, you know. No, it is addition by subtraction kind of thing. And there are times where, as I say, Sam just, you know, he doesn't play a flood of notes. He'll play one note, and he can play it longer than you can take it, and he'll play it longer still if he feels like that's the note that the moment deserves. So, yeah, I saw this, you know, they had reviews up on our website, and it was like, best album of the year, and blah, blah, blah. I don't think it's crazy to, it's possible that this might be one of the handful of the best improvised records from last year. I've never can claim I've heard them all, but I feel like they got somewhere fairly special.
Well, yeah. So just the only thing I want to add or, you know, reiterate is no complaints about level of craftsmanship of the musicianship here or the empathy that they have with one another. It's just that Sam's horn at times is tough for me to take.
And he made apparently a series of solo soprano saxophone recordings. And that is probably one reason I know about this guy, but I haven't pursued him. Now I'm a little interested, but at the same time, I'm like, you know, he's a guy that makes
a little frightened too.
Exactly. He's a guy that makes Steve Lacy sound like Johnny Hodges. He's like, okay, I think I'll just hide under this couch. Not that there's no humor or here, but yeah, he's a serious guy. He's not screwing around.
You go to my head and you linger like a haunting refrain. Though I see you spinning round in my brain, like the bubbles in a glass of champagne. You go to my head like a sip of sparkling burgundy blue, and I find the very mention.
Okay, well, our last selection was one you picked. It's by a vocalist, so a little change of pace.
Yeah, Christina Koller, and she just had another EP come out. She was out here on the West Coast, and I wanted to get out to see her, and I was sick the day it would involve a drive up to LA, which, if you live in San Diego, that's a real test of endurance, just because of the way the freeways work. And I wanted to go, but I couldn't quite bring myself to drag myself 4 hours of driving. So sorry, Christina. So, you know, I'll tell you what, the reason I picked this is almost entirely for one song initially, and then the more I listened to this, the better I liked it. I don't think that this vocalist is the second coming of Sarah Vaughan or Billie Holiday or anything like that, but I feel like she knows what she's doing, and she has a really good idea about how to change up the feel of standards so that they continue to hold interest today. So the song, and I don't know if it's an original or not, the song that just kind of got me, and it's a beer worm, I cannot get this fucking song out of my head, is Skinny Love.
Come on, Skinny Love, just last the year. poor a little soul, we were never here. My. Staring at the sink of love and crushed veneer.
I fucking love that song. I just cannot. It's got this hook and it's got this lyric. It just works for me. I don't know why. I'm absolutely hooked on that song. But I'll tell you a good example of how she mixes stuff up. I think would be the kind of take that she and her band have on "Nice Work If You Can Get It." They set it up as kind of, they play it, they take it in a minor key, and the pianist is playing these, what's he playing there? Arpeggios, triplets, da-da-da-da, this sort of repetitive driving thing, which then the drummer picks up on as this kind of driving rhythm. It's not Rosemary Clooney's take on that song, is it? It's this thoughtful, smoky, driving, riff-based take on the song. I just think it's fantastic. And she does that over and over again with the different covers on this album. So I feel like she has the capacity consistently, she or her arrangers or whomever's in charge of this. It's a self-produced album it's on her own label, I guess. Whoever's in charge of all of this just has a really good idea about how to do standards in a way that I find consistently offbeat and compelling. Just because it's offbeat doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be good, but I feel like this is consistently good. I don't know that she has the best range, and I'm going to guess that you're going to have issues with her voice in a couple of songs with intonation.
You are psychic, sir.
But I don't give a fuck. I just love this album to death. I think it's really, really good. I really enjoy it a lot. Go ahead, complain about the intonation. I already knew you were going there.
There are issues there, sustaining notes, but I don't know that her approach, which to me, just the way she sings, as opposed to, I agree, the arrangements are good. I got to admit, when you start off with "You Go to My Head" and it's not miles away from the way Cassandra Wilson did it a few years back, it's like, yeah, shoot at a king, you don't want to miss kind of thing. But, you know, it's not identical. We're getting a little close. She kind of sings, the way she ornaments melodies to me is kind of a, I don't know if I want to call it a soul. You know, it's got like, it's like kind of a little melisma. It's the way that she moves around things. And I'm not that enamored of it. Just the way she delivers, just the way she sings, just her instrument, you know, just the way her voice sounds and the way she moves it around.
Oh, you bastard.
So yeah, that was my main thing, is that just the way she sings, not terrible by any means, but the ornamentation she uses, the, you know, the sliding around the notes, which to me, again, is, you know, I don't have a great vocabulary for it. Sounds a little bit like soul music. I would prefer another approach, and that's just the way she's going to do it. So too bad, Patrick. I think the song selection is interesting. You know, Utopia to me, when the ukulele comes out.
No drama, no hustle and a bustle, just me and this beautiful city. I'll take a road trip to a place I've always wanted to see. No regrets, bad memories or mishaps, just the thought of a new beginning. I'll start a life I've always dreamed of having.
I don't think she's trying to be snarky the way Nellie McKay is. I'm not sure. I mean, is it possible not to be snarky when you're playing ukulele? Is it kind of an intrinsically ironic instrument? But that was another moment where, and again, this is, she's like 23 maybe, is that right? She's pretty young.
She's very young.
So, you know, that may just be a reflection that 5 years down the road here, things are going to be a little bit more solidified and distinctive. Everybody at that age is kind of, to some degree, unless you're just a real anomaly, trying on approaches and borrowing in a way that's going to get a little bit more integrated a few years down. So, I guess, but for me, just the quality of the voice, it's not the richest instrument. The pitch is not perfect. Sometimes breath control doesn't seem to be all the way there, you know, like the trailing of notes, little issues. conceptually interesting. You know, I like that. And that means to me a lot of promise, because that other stuff, everybody, you can always develop that. But if you don't have interesting things to say, that's probably not going to suddenly come to you later on. It can, but it's a little harder to, you can't practice that as much.
Well, I'll also point out, I mean, so I agree. I guess I agree with much of what you say. I like the triumph of style over, I guess, what you're claiming is a lack of substance. And I think some of the choices are not, she picked some difficult songs. So I'll Know from the soundtrack of Guys and Dolls is a fiendishly difficult song to sing. If you want to know how badly wrong it can go, watch Marlon Brando try to sing it in the movie. It's a really bad moment. It's an incredibly difficult song. And I like her version. Like I said, I could anticipate what some of your critiques are going to be, but I don't care. I really like some of the moves she makes here. And like I said, a couple of the songs, Nice Work If You Can Get It, I love her take, and I swear to God, Skinny Love has just been in my head for 2 weeks solid. Actually, it's been in my head for longer than that. I think that's an original, or am I wrong? Do you know?
I'm assuming. There are a handful here that, you know, Utopia, Skinny Love, I don't know. Now, there are also a couple of songs that are, you know, by like pop bands.
Yeah.
And they would have hit me harder if I knew their music, but not knowing them, you know, they're not groups that I'm aware, you know, I've heard of, but I mean, not I've ever listened to. So I did not get the thrill of recontextualization that somebody hipper than me who was, you know, had heard the originals would have gotten. Let's just put it, it's not one this old guy knows. So okay. It's either an original or one that, you know, she borrowed from a less predictable source. It wasn't, you know, Gas, Great American Songbook stuff.
So, okay.
Yeah. You know, she's an up-and-comer. Someone described her as a new NU diva. I don't know what that even means, but is she a new diva?
I think when you say new NU, it's always supposed to be, you know, you hear about new jazz or new metal. It's always supposed to be some hyper-contemporary take on an established genre. I don't know what it would mean to call her a new diva. Jazz has plenty of divas who have limited instruments, and that sounds like I'm dissing her, like she has limited instrument, but I take your point about some of the issues with intonation. I anticipated them. I don't care. I like this. I just okay. like this, and I'm really interested to see where she goes from here, because I thought this was someone who had some interesting originals and dipped into the gas, but without just going for on-the-nose interpretations, was doing some interesting arrangements throughout. So I kind of want to see, when you start there, that's a good place to start, it seems.
And it was a good choice because, yeah, she is not going to just kind of march in and say, I'm going to impress you with the straight-ahead reading of the song just because I'm so fucking gifted.
Right.
You know, she's not a Cecile McLaurin Sullivan with just a once-in-a-generation voice
right.
that can do anything. So, you know, her spin, and, you know, Sullivan obviously is spinning the hell out of stuff. I mean, she's extremely a hands-on interpreter, but she's also just got this voice that will floor you. And so she can just kind of coast on that if she wants to anyway. Whereas here, yeah, this is somebody who's got, you know, a serviceable but not fantastic instrument to deal with. So, you know, she's got to think about presentation.
It's like, I think about, like, an analogy would be with, like, writers, novelists. There are some novelists who have just beautiful prose styles. And forget about plot. You just read them for the poetry of the language. And then there are others who are really good plotters. They have a really good story to tell. And then there are, you know, the occasional masters who can do both, right? I don't know if this makes her a plotter or a poet, probably more of a plotter.
The weird thing is that both kinds of writers are always alcoholics. I don't know why, but they always are.
You know, but I mean, you know, there are people who are, you know, they have the craftsmanship at the level of the sentence that you don't give a shit what they're talking about. It's just beautiful.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. And maybe that's like, you know, if I could extend the analogy, that's someone like, you know, Sullivan, whose voice, she could sing the phone book and you'd just be like, oh my God. And then there are people who can tell really good stories, you know. And so maybe that's the Christina caller who can have an interpretation or a take that is offbeat and interesting in and of itself. Which isn't to say that Sullivan can't do that, she can. She's got all the tools in the toolbox.
Oh, yeah. She's got endless personality. All right. Well, sir, you got any pop matters on your mind?
Nothing particularly. Just listening to old stuff. I haven't rotated anything in particularly exciting lately. So, no. What are you?
Okay. Well, an old thing that I enjoyed more than I expected was I listened to the Mott the Hoople debut album. And that was the first time I probably enjoyed it beginning to end. I guess I'm getting more indulgent in my old age. There are certainly some high points on that. Sonny Bono's Laugh at Me being one of them. So if you've never heard Mott the Hoople, probably not their strongest, but it's fun. And then Pop Market had a 4-LP set of Curtis Mayfield stuff on sale. I did not buy it, but
why not?
I don't know. I don't want to get divorced. Something about Rain going to college. I can't remember. There's some kind of argument there that maybe I shouldn't get everything I see. But it did not include Superfly, which I guess most people acknowledge as his masterpiece. And I just thought, well, you know, I haven't ever listened to much Curtis Mayfield, so I ended up listening to the latest album in the packet, which was not that well reviewed, Sweet Exorcist, and even that album, which is apparently not his strongest, I really enjoyed. So I guess I'm just a sucker for like overdone 70s production and falsetto singing and funk. I just, you know, I'm a sucker. So apparently I'm going to like anything Curtis does, because Sweet Exorcist, not supposed to be one of his top three, still a hell of a lot of fun. Yeah, if you want to get on a magic carpet and go back to the 70s, it doesn't all make sense, but it's fun enough.
Okay. I do have Pop Matters, I just realized. So I have a couple things to say. Sorry, it was a
show. No, it's fine.
Stuff came up.
I evoke, man. It's like it brings back the trauma. It brings things to the surface.
It does. Since you were complaining about singers with intonation, I recently re-listened to something I own to my shame and embarrassment, which I believe is not ironically titled, but I probably should be considered a title of irony. The best of, you're never going to guess what the next two words out of my mouth are.
I it's not Barbara Streisand, because she at least has got intonation.
Perfect, so perfect pitch. Yeah, no. Sheena Easton.
Okay. What was her big hit?
Oh, she had a few. She sang a Bond song, For Your Eyes Only.
Oh, right. Okay.
She sang a duet. She and Kenny Rogers re-recorded Bob Seger's Dashboard makeout song, We've Got Tonight.
Okay.
Don't you remember that one? We've Got Tonight. She's famous for being incredibly off key. Like, there's a singer who's 20 years before auto-tune, and it really would have helped her.
Okay.
You know, like, if auto-tune had been around, I mean, she's just always flat. I mean, always flat. Not sometimes. It's just a question of how much. You know, she is the Eric Dolphy of singers. You know, I imagine the whole band is always ahead of them.
Oh, I think Dolphy was always sharp, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was sharp. I just meant, you know, how Ron Carter would say you would have to adjust his playing in order to keep Dolphy in tune. So Sheena Easton's band needs to consistently alter their tone to keep her in tune. She's terrible. But for some reason, I have this. And so I was listening to it again recently, you know. The only thing that kind of made her career better later was Prince got a hold of her, and he had some songs that were only good for a woman to sing, although you can imagine him singing them. So she had this song called Strut, and it's a Prince song. She recorded a couple of his, I think he produced one of her albums, and he had these sort of, you know, funk songs that are all about like sass and you look at my ass and this is all you want from women, which you could imagine actually he could sing that. But and sing it better than she did. But Strut is a song that I believe he wrote for her. And there's a connection. She's Scottish. And I always wonder, you know, she was very pretty. I just wonder, how did he look at her and go, you know what? She could sing some of these songs that I have for a woman's voice. I'm going to pick this consistently off-key Scottish hottie to sing my music. I don't know. It's very weird. So I thought of that since you mentioned Pop Matters. And then I did recently acquire my second John Grant album. John Grant is this really interesting.
Is he Queen of Denmark?
He's Queen of Denmark.
Ah, that's a great record. Yeah. That, okay. That turned me on to.
That is a great record, which I got turned on to because of my habit of randomly watching. I have a weird random system of, you know, picking movies on Netflix, and I saw a gay love story. This is what happens when you randomize your film viewing. I saw this gay love story, which was really good, independent film called Weekend. And John Grant did several of his songs are on that. And I remember when I saw the movie, I was like, I fucking got to find this guy.
That's weird, because he is so aggressively heterosexual that I joke, I can't.
This is an album called, it's a stupid title, Gray Tickles Black Pressure.
Okay.
And Grant has been living, I don't know if he still lives there, but he has been living in Iceland. I don't know if he still lives there. I think he was living in Iceland. Anyway, you'd think that, you know, then that would make him a natural to sort of go all Jens Lekman. But instead, the presiding muse here seems to be E of Eels. It's as if John Grant is doing the Eels on this album. It's weird. It's not nearly as good as Queen of Denmark. And it has one song that I think someone actually tried to turn me on to, a song called Global Warming. And it's just wrong. It's just a bad song.
Oh, that's too bad.
I mean, not in terms of the lyrics. Normally his lyrics, he's good about the whole self-loathing. And he's got a nice corner on the angry self-loathing market.
Well, he also is happy to loathe others.
That's true, too.
Yes.
But that's what makes it sort of redeeming. Global Warming is a song about if he had been in New York in the 70s, he would have gotten all the really interesting diseases. And, you know, there's little kids somewhere everywhere dying of cancer. It's a bad song. Like, lyrically, it's one of the first times I heard a song by him, and I was like, wow, this is stupid. Like, this is an embarrassing song. And I'm going to guess that a lot of people love the shit out of this song because someone mentioned it to me as being interesting, and I was like, this is terrible. This is bathos. This is embarrassment. It's the first song I heard by him. I was like, wow, that shouldn't have been recorded. Like, that's a dumb, dumb, dumb idea for a song.
Okay.
So I think it's Global Warming. No, it's not Global Warming, because I'm listening to it in my ear right now, and it's not. I like Global Warming. That's the good song. What the fucking song is it? Oh, Disappointing. It's Disappointing.
Rewind, people.
Whatever. I can't think of it. I can't figure out which song it is.
Never mind. While you think about that, quick reports on a couple of live concerts I got to. I saw the Bad Plus at the Jazz Kitchen. And they are now, they've added a new member. So Ethan Iverson, is that the basketball player? Help me out here. Who is the piano player in the Bad Plus?
Ethan Iverson. Yeah, Ethan. That's correct.
All right.
You're thinking of the basketball player? Iverson.
That's somebody else. You're
that's
right.
Anyway. Alan Iverson.
Thank you, sir. I'm so into jazz that instead of confusing people with basketball players, I confuse basketball players with the jazz bows. That's how I know what I am. Anyway, he left the group. We've talked about their stuff before, I think a couple times, actually.
We talked about
them on For All I Care, their album Pop Covers back on episode 4, and then The Rite of Spring on episode 53. And, you know, now looking back, that's from 2013. I wonder if that was getting close to the breaking point that Iverson was more into classical music. Those guys were more into pop and rock. And I don't know, but it's just, you kind of wonder now whether that was about the end of the road for the three of them. So now Orrin Evans, a piano player that I tend to associate with Chicago, has joined them, with bassist Reed Anderson and drummer Dave King, who've been along for the whole ride. And, you know, they gave a fine performance. Sound was good. Reed Anderson's quite humorous. He was kind of, he and King are kind of like an old married couple. King doesn't say much, but they're kind of joshing with each other all the time. In some ways, I think Oren maybe is an improvement. I think he's got a little bit more interesting touch. Sometimes I felt like Ethan was pounding away, and maybe that was his take on what Rock needed to be. I'm not sure. The thing I really noticed, if you knew them back in the day, you might associate them with covers of rock material. That was part of what made them controversial. The set I listened to was all originals. And some of them had great titles like Keep the Bugs Off Your Glass and The Bears Off Your Ass. And Reed did this great riff on CB radio and all the rest, you know. But they're all fine. I think they all work. But I really wish, to be honest, they'd played something that was by someone else, you know, just as context. I think grappling with the pop oeuvre is not a dead end. I think it's a good idea. And I think that the best known pop melodies of the last 40 years are more memorable than the Bad Pluses melodies, which again, perfectly pleasant. You know, are they getting a little bit closer to a group like EST? A little, maybe. I mean, King's always going to be a muscular drummer. In some ways, I think he was the most interesting performer. Evans is an amazing pianist. I don't know. I know I've got him on some recordings, but, you know, technique is out of the park. But so many of their tunes were two or three chord cycles that he would do amazing elaborations, but they were finally elaborations. I mean, there wasn't quite enough harmonic meat to produce what I would consider, you know, really interesting linear improv. And that's not really what they're trying to do. I think they're trying to kind of give the listeners a fragment of melody to hang on to and enjoy. And in some ways, it was a more modulated performance than I'd heard from them before, but I wish the repertoire had been more interesting. So anyway, I felt almost obligated to go and see what was going on with the new piano player in the group. And of course, the jazz, the kitchen's great. Sound there was really fine. I mean, sometimes the bass gets a little out of control in that room, but they did not have that problem. They did a good job of being extremely lucid sonically. And it was a packed room. So there's an audience out there. And I'd say I wasn't the oldest guy in the room, but I was well above the median, which was nice to see. So they've clearly got it. And because they're really, I'm guessing, roughly our age.
Right.
Every one of them, a lot more hair on the chin than on the top of the head. Very avuncular at this point, but fun musicians, and it was enjoyable. Then surprisingly, the next night, I was at the Bangkok Jazz Bar and Thai restaurant after a performance of the Indianapolis Symphony. And they moved the live performers there later in the evening. They'll have live musicians, typically a duet on Fridays and Saturdays. And this ended up being a very late meal because, you know, the symphony went till about 7:30, and then there's a backup in the kitchen. We didn't get seated for 45 minutes, at which point I was actually in low blood sugar, which is very, very rare for me. But I was like, bring me an appetizer or a piece of bread or a candy bar, or I'm just going to start doing bad things. And they did. They were very helpful. But anyway, there was a duet there, a piano player and an electric violinist. And the piano player, I got his card. Larry Aroney, I want to guess. He's a Latin jazz pianist. And the violin player was Kathy Morris. She said, just remember Morris the Cat. And I said, just remember Jazz the Bastard if you want to listen to the podcast. They were mainly doing standards. And it was really, really enjoyable. You know, she had a lot, both of them had a lot of personality. I mean, she was doing more of the melodies. And, you know, she had one of those Laurie Anderson, Jean-Luc Ponty, you know, electric violins. I mean, it was not a regular violin with a pickup. It was the, you know, little skinny thing with no sound box. And there's some delay on it. So when she did pizzicato, you know, it'd be kind of almost two notes kind of thing. And, you know, this played standards, but it turns out the gas with that particular combination with a lot of personality behind it, this sounds different. So if you run across them in the Indianapolis area, I strongly recommend you listen. They're in some ways, I enjoy their performance more than the Bad Pluses. And they were doing what, you know, I don't in general, I'm not thrilled with, which is just mainly, you know, real book stuff. It was not a lot of surprises, but you know, they just played with a lot of heart and feeling. She was very distinctive and never, the danger with electric violin is it might get grotesque or it might get overdone. And, you know, in a supper setting, you can't, you know, they were performing while people ate Thai food. So, you know, they couldn't go crazy and they didn't. And it was, you know, it worked really well. And it was nice to have them. They used to stick the musicians way back in the bar where no one could see them, and they brought them to the front. So that was a nice thing. So that's my little book report on two. It's not a book report. It's my little listening report on two very different concerts.
Okay.
With a twist ending.
Nice.
You like the people you've never heard of as much as the Bad Plus, at least if you're me.
Okay.
All right.
I found the lyrics, so I can test these lyrics on you and see if you agree that these are really bad.
Listeners, write in and tell.
So this is from his song. There are people who love this song called "Gray Tickles Black Pressure." It's the title cut, and the lyrics are one of the lyrics are, "And there are children who have cancer, and so all bets are off because I can't compete with that. So all bets are off because I can't compete with that. I've got gray tickles and black pressure, and I'd rather lose my arm inside of a corn thresher, just like Uncle Paul."
Okay, well, you know, his lyrics are not the most coherent part of The Queen of Denmark, but yeah, okay. He's freestyling it, you know.
When I hear this, and you have to imagine the sort of lugubrious, self-indulgent, sad, you know, 70s multi-vocal tract,
right?
You know, mojo here, and it's like, really? Wow, this is the height of self-indulgence, or the depth of it, or something. It's not good. All right, okay. That's my pop matter. Sorry, so there.
One and two and.
Thank you for all those cards and letters you folks in television land. We wonder where this television land is. Could it be a couple of miles from where Disneyland is? Oh well, nevertheless.
Just want to mention in passing as we head out of this episode that we did get a few emails. They're always appreciated. Some ideas. Derek from Peoria suggested that two artists we have never discussed are Art Blakey and Warren Marsh.
Have we not talked about Warren Marsh? I could have sworn we had.
I don't think so. I mean, and Blakey we certainly brought up many times. All I could get was a picture of Warren Marsh playing with Art Blakey.
That's a little terrifying, isn't it?
That would not go well. You know, Lenny Tristano's school is like basically anti-Blakey. But yeah, both artists, it'd be fun to just kind of, you know, for me, Blakey is a band leader, is a great incubator of talent. And I think, in fact, we probably did talk about a session he led that featured Wynton Marsalis on that Wynton show.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But of course, reissued under Wynton's name. I mean, it was well after his fingerprint had been long established, and it was the interest of the release was not what Blakey was up to. So, you know, and I don't know. We've talked about Tristano. I think Lee Konitz he's gotten featured once or twice, but Warren is not somebody I've studied as much. So anyway, something to think about. Another one that starts off, let me see who's this from. Greg, who I love, the beginning of this is awesome. It's like, thanks for the tip on Shatner's bassoon. Best jazz bastard find since Jerry Mulligan. Again, another juxtaposition. Like, Jerry Mulligan and Shatner, I love them both, myself too. I mean, I'm not mocking this. It's just like, wouldn't that be odd if they got together? That would be a very strange thing. I think Shatner's bassoon would end up someplace that Shatner didn't like it after that. Both great groups. So he mentioned that we often bring up Sun Ra and Frank Zappa. He would like a show featuring two albums by each. And so, you know, I told him, well, we've done Sun Ra a couple times. We did Zappa once. But, you know, I'm happy for suggestions, especially Zappa, because, again, I just did not know the guy's work. And it is obviously extensive and impressive. So a thought. We'll see. We'll have to think about that someday.
You never have to twist my arm to talk about Sun Ra.
I know. I mean, I was going to say, you know, I will complain about him occasionally, but you're a great a promoter of him. And it's not, I enjoy some of his stuff quite a bit, of course. And they're both, you know, he didn't mention, there's a number of similarities they have. They're both anti-drinking and drugs. I thought, and they were both control freaks. Productive
control freaks. Brainwashed.
They're musicians.
They're sidemen.
Their bands are all
them mercilessly.
But, you know, I mean, there's all three. Yeah, exactly. But so a thought. And then Mike from Chicago, not this Mike from Chicago, another Mike from Chicago, had some great pointers on Polish jazz we might discuss and a book about a Polish record label I was not aware of. So we'll see if I
do. What does he recommend for Polish jazz? I know some. I'm just curious what he wants to name check.
Well, part of the thing is that instead of name checking, he gave me a YouTube link. So he's like, you might know about this one, and I haven't clicked the link yet. Nothing against him. I just rarely watch YouTube, but he mentions that Stanko was on that. So
we did one episode on him, and the other sort of great Polish player who we'd never talked about, but and whose stuff is hard to get in this country, is Krzysztof Komeda. He's the monumental figure, but it's really hard to find. I'm saying this because I've tried often to find his stuff, and it's fucking impossible.
Well, he's also given me a link to a YouTuber. He said he's put a bunch of the Polish records online. So part of this is just me being old-fashioned and not typically listening to music through YouTube, which I know millions of people do. I mean, that is kind of their jukebox. And I, you know, again, not being critical of it, just not the way I've tended to do it. But I will want to look him up. He also mentioned Yosuke Yamashita. Sounds like she's pretty avant-garde. He says kind of a Cecil Taylor, Alexander von Schlippenbach style.
Hmm.
And Don Rendell, Ian Carr quintet. So anyway, just things to look at. And again, we appreciate the kind thoughts from Mike in Chicago, as well as Greg and from Derek. So thank you for writing in. We do appreciate it. We're going to take these things under consideration.
Yeah, we're definitely going to do. I mean, I've been feeling this as well, that all of the emphasis on new stuff has been great. But we both have thought for a while now we need to
dip
a little more deeply back into, have a whole fucking Blue Note episode.
Ruby
Van Gelder special.
And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 160. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop me a line on Facebook, or if you want, look me up on All About Jazz. Right now, just to promo myself a bit, there's an article at All About Jazz on Blue Note's new Tone Poet vinyl reissue series. So if you want to read some very opinionated thoughts about the 18 albums they're going to be releasing over this year in heavyweight vinyl, check it out. Again, Blue Note's Tone Poet series. Podcast can be downloaded at www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, or if you like, you can stream it a few days later on All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we devote an episode to the music of Warren Marsh and Art Blakey. Until then, take care.
Now helmets on each head, awaiting the first lead. The pageant is named the Pencil Rain.
Do you have a pen in your hand or something?
Yes, I do. Get over it. Oh my God, Mr. Sensitive Ears. Holy shit.
I can't edit that out of the podcast. You do it to yourself, dude. I'm just saying.
Jesus, who cares? My God.
Okay. Who's Mr. Clicky? It's okay. He's fine. He won't hurt you.
God,
I'm scared of Mr. Clicky.
So uptight.
The pencil rain.